Paul, Professor Paul Davies, welcome again to The Last Post magazine to discuss more about your wonderful book, The Demon in the Machine. How are you?
Very well, and I'm delighted to be talking to you again.
Yes, it's a wonderful thing, and such an amazing book that covers so many subjects and topics regarding the mind, time, space, life itself. I think, Paul, was it George Whitesides that questioned the remarkability, if there's such a word as remarkability, of life? And if so, how remarkable is life?
You're quite right that George Whitesides, a chemist at Harvard University, who I actually know rather well, is quite explicit about the fact that as a chemist, when he thinks about the elaborate web of interactions that life deploys, he says he knows of nothing like it. Outside of life, there's nothing that can resemble it. It's in a class apart. And so he, along with a long tradition of chemists and physicists, feel that there's something really missing from the austere account of what is life, which is that it's just complex chemistry. There has to be something else going on.
There's really no point of reference.
There's nothing, that's the thing. We have life and we have non-life, and there's a huge gulf. Where all this would become a lot easier is if we had a second sample of life, if we could say, aha, so these two things are living, they have these common features, and that's what sets them apart, and then the rest is non-living. But in the absence of another sample of life, we've only got one, it's really very hard to know what it is exactly that sets it apart.
Pardon the two questions in the one question, if you like, but is it a miracle, and where did it begin?
Well, as a scientist, of course, I don't believe in miracles or magic. I think there was a perfectly straightforward physical process turning on life into life. I say straightforward, that there's nothing magical, but we don't know what it was, and I don't think personally that known physics explains it. That means new physics will explain it. So this isn't a question of, well, physics can't explain life, so we need a miracle. It's saying we need new physics. And I think we will glimpse that new physics at work if we look very carefully into the way that living systems organize their information and their management structure. They really are like human societies. A living cell is teeming with complex messages and information and organization, pretty much like a city. It's got that level of complexity. And if we understand something about the way the information and the chemistry mesh together, then I think we will begin to see the pathway that takes us from non-life to life. So new physics, I think new concepts as well, but no miracles.
No, that's right, and concepts, Paul, that we may not yet know of.
Right. Now, you said, of course, how did it begin? That's the point. We need to know how to go from non-life to life. There wasn't always life on Earth, and, of course, we don't know that Earth life actually began on Earth. It may have begun somewhere else, but that just pushes the problem off. Somewhere in the universe, non-life, a mishmash of chemicals, must have been transformed into a living thing. That pathway from non-life to life may have been long and tortuous. It may have been inevitable, or it may have been a bizarre sequence of accidents, a dream run of chemical reactions. We don't know. But until we understand the physics of life in more detail, it's going to be very hard to answer that question, unless, of course, we just discover a second sample of life, and then that would transform everything.
Yes, indeed. I imagine so. Also, I guess the question that is mentioned by you in this book, The Demon in the Machine, is life widespread in the cosmos, or is it a one in a billion accident?
So it really boils down to, what are the chances, if you have a suitable planet and all the right sort of chemical stuff lying around, that it will turn itself into a simple living thing, a simple cell, for example, after, I don't know, 100 million years or billion years or something. What are those odds? Now, we have no idea because we don't know what that process was. And what I like to say is you can't estimate the odds of an unknown process. I get asked time and again by journalists, well, what are the chances that we're going to find life elsewhere out there in the universe? And I say, it's impossible for anybody to answer that question because it hinges on the probability of non-life turning into life. And if you knew what the process was that did it, you'd be in with a chance of estimating that probability. But we don't, and so we can't put a number to it. Quite unlike, I should say, how life evolved on Earth from simple cells to complex organisms like human beings. That process we do understand. It's called Darwinian evolution. We still don't know how to work out the odds. If you have a planet with primitive life, come back a few billion years later, will it have radio telescopes and spacecraft and so on? We don't know how to do that calculation, but there's no mystery about the process. We understand how life complexifies once it gets going. We don't understand how it got going in the first place.
Yes, that's right, of course. And I guess too, Paul, as so well explained by yourself just there, the explanations of the likelihood of life outside our immediate area, of course, in space, the understanding of the likelihood of that is as you said, is as likely as being able to tell whether or not if you started life you would come back in 10,000 years and see advancements that have been made similar to the humankind. So a very complex and very hard question to answer. But I guess with it was the ancient Romans knew nothing about consciousness, and I think you say in the book, more or less, that we haven't progressed much since then.
Consciousness is an even more of a mystery than life. We tend to think that the two go together, that you can't have consciousness without life, although these days some people think we can have conscious computers, or will do one day, or robots or something. Mm-hmm. That's a separate question. When consciousness arises naturally in the universe, life is a pathway to it, and if the origin of life is a mystery, then the origin of consciousness is a double mystery. It's really hard to know what to say about it, because unlike everything else in science, where you can be objective, you can stand outside the system that you are looking at and studying, and somebody else can study the same thing and say, well, I agree, we observe this or we observe that. When it comes to your own consciousness, there's only you that can examine it. You're looking at it from the inside out. And whilst we can certainly study the brain and all the complex neural functions, and we can work out the correlates, the neural correlates, as philosophers call it, between this bit of brain lighting up and that sensation or feeling or thought, and that bit, and so on, we can map that. But getting to this deeper problem of what is this thing, the subjective feeling that we all have, the sensations, what philosophers call qualia. When I look at red, it's completely different to me from green, and to you as well, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. We have no idea whether my sensation of red matches your sensation of red, because I call it red because that's what I see every time. But nobody who has these sensations is in any doubt that they're real. And they're completely different, for example, from the sound of a bell or the feeling of water running through your hands. These qualia are real to us, they're real experiences, and we can't find anything in science that corresponds to them. All we can say is that when you have these sensations, this is what the brain does. But getting to the bottom of the subjective element of consciousness is something that certainly is beyond current science, and it may be it will forever lie beyond the scope of the scientific method, because, as I said earlier, we're looking at this from the inside out.
Yes, and I was wondering that myself, actually. When you spoke about the definition of the colour red and green, I was thinking about people being asked to explain their art, because it would appear different to everyone.
Well, of course, art is very much beauty being in the eye of the beholder. That's true. There's a judgment like that. But an artist will have a vision, a conception of what they're trying to convey. And if they're successful, then they may communicate that in part to other people. But only they really know what it is that they're they're driving at, of course. And so everyday life is just full of these things, that we're conscious beings and we look out on the world and we have these feelings. But I think the flip side of that is that the vast majority of things we do unconsciously. Our brains tick over perfectly well without this thing called consciousness. If you walk across a room or even drive a car, and let alone your heart going on beating and all the other sort of things, care and maintenance functions of the body, the brain does all that without us being conscious of it. And we have no idea, really, how those things are separated. Why is it that some things come to our conscious attention? We imagine that we are agents who are presented with situations and we make decisions and we have some sort of free will, and then we can act on those decisions. But the more we study the brain, the more it seems that that's a bit of an illusion. And it leaves you wondering, why do we need this thing called consciousness when we can do so much unconsciously? There's an example I like to give. I'm a bit of a crossword fanatic.
Right.
Been doing a lot of them during the lockdown.
Ben.
And it's a very curious thing that I can be totally stuck on a clue, fall asleep, put it down, and wake up in the morning, look at it again, and immediately I've got the answer. It's almost as if my brain, my unconscious brain, has figured it out whilst I've been asleep, and it delivers the answer to my consciousness. And I think, oh, I solved that, but did I? Or did my brain solve it? And the I that corresponds to consciousness is just the recipient of the solution.
Yes, how brilliant. How brilliant, actually. And that prompts another question, which I didn't have listed, but with sleeping, and I know it's happened to you, it's happened to most people, I would imagine, where a dream will appear, and part of that dream, at least, will turn out to be reality in some way.
Well, of course, dreams are imperfect reflections of reality or distortions of reality or sometimes, well, we could call them virtual reality. But there are two quite distinct types of dreams. There's the sort of wishy-washy ones that we have most of the time where things don't make a great deal of sense and they slide around and juxtapose scenes and situations from everyday life, and then we sort of weave our way through it. And then there's a different type of dreaming called lucid dreaming, and that's something that I have experienced, and other people may have experienced that as well. It's a well-known phenomenon. And in a lucid dream, you know that you're asleep, you know that you're dreaming, and everything takes on the full technicolor reality of the waking life. And in fact, when I began lucid dreaming as a teenager, it was quite terrifying because I thought this was the waking life, this was the world, and I was paralyzed. I couldn't get out of bed, and I was looking around the room, and I could see my room in all its detail, and I couldn't move. In fact, I was sleeping. Now, it's interesting thought that because ordinary dreams are so fragmented and peculiar, are lucid dreams closer when it comes to physics, to the laws of physics, to the real world? Does it just look like the everyday world, or does it behave like the everyday world? And I did have an occasion, a lucid dream some years ago, in which I was looking in a mirror, and I actually took the trouble to see if the image was inverted, and it was.
Wow.
And so next time I have a lucid dream, I want to do the Galileo experiment of dropping two objects to see if they hit the ground at the same time.
Wow, isn't that incredible? I guess just as a side thing too, just briefly, and you don't have to comment on it, but I must tell you that in 1984, I had a dream. Paul Hogan had been out of the scene for some time, but I had a dream that he had re-emerged as an international movie star. A couple of days after that, there was an advert in The Age, the Melbourne Age, asking for people to become shareholders in Paul's new international movie plan, which turned out to be Crocodile Dundee. And I went against my dream, and I didn't... I thought I'll contribute to that later, but I never did. So that was that.
Well, you missed out on that one. Yes.
I didn't.
Of course, people do claim that they dream of future events, or sometimes I think what they're dreaming of is current events that they weren't aware of.
Yes.
They picked it up subliminally or something.
Yes.
But when people say, well, I, you know, crashed the car and I dreamt of that the night before, and actually it happened to me, I think the point is that that you remember those cases where the dreams turn out to be correct.
Yes.
Forget all the ones that don't correspond to anything that happened.
Yes, well, I hope the car accident wasn't too serious.
No, it wasn't. The car ended up upside down, but nobody was hurt.
That's incredible. And, Paul, I guess we've covered this in our conversation just on the subject, but it says you look like you are thinking, therefore you exist. I guess that's about consciousness.
Well, this is a famous quote of René Descartes, who wrestled, as did the ancient Greeks, with this problem of consciousness. And what he wanted to do was to separate out the mind stuff, if you like, from the bodily stuff. He saw them as quite distinct. He wanted to get down to the most fundamental aspect of reality, the thing that we could most be sure of, because, of course, there are so many illusions in the world. How do you know what's real out there and what isn't? But the one thing you can be sure of is your own existence. So this, hence his quote, I think, therefore I am. But he saw consciousness as, or the mind, as a bit like the, we would now say, the driver of a vehicle, that the driver can steer the vehicle in some particular direction. And Descartes saw the body as like the vehicle and the mind as the driver. And so a human being, for example, would then consist of two components, a body and a mind, and that these would be coupled somehow in the brain. It's a philosophy known as dualism, because it says human beings are made of two different kinds of things. And it fell very much out of favor with philosophers and theologians as well. Don't like the idea that we have these sort of separate bits, that they prefer to think of human beings as unitary or integral individuals. But dualism hasn't totally gone away. Some people still feel that we can't explain consciousness without some fundamentally additional stuff or concept or entity. But exactly how these two bits would couple together still remains deeply mysterious.
It's incredible, really, Paul, because, of course, we have the physical nature of the beast and then a hole in the head that is filled with the brain, which is more than that. So I guess I understand what you're saying. That was an intrigue to me too, I guess. But you, in your book, you speak of a Platonic realm, was it, of mathematical forms and relationships that it lies beyond time and space, external input. Is that what you were talking about, or?
Yes. It's called Platonic because Plato had the idea that mathematics has an independent existence. It applies to the real world, the physical world, but it has an existence independently of the physical world. So, for example, the statement 11 is a prime number would be true whether there's a universe or not. So mathematical relationships seem to live in a world of their own. It's not within space and time. It's not this physical world. And yet we can come to know it. Human beings can come to know mathematics, which sort of exists in its own realm, its own reality. And this has long puzzled mathematicians and physicists because, of course, the laws of physics are mathematical relationships. And we have the impression that we don't invent those mathematical relationships, we discover them. We explore the world, we discover the mathematics, and we apply it. But it somehow must, these laws and the mathematical relationships must exist outside of the physical universe. And then it's some mathematicians at least wonder how it is that we can gain access to that realm. So it seems a little bit mystical, and not all mathematicians are Platonists in that sense. Some think that, well, mathematics is just a lot of things that humans invent. And this is unresolved, even after 2,500 years, even since Plato said that this was an issue. Modern mathematicians haven't really decided what they think.
So mathematics can be exciting, but depending on a view of whether or not you agree to the Platonic version. But yeah, that's incredible in itself. I guess just as an instance, tell me if I'm on the wrong track here, but would that be in accordance with someone, for example, like I do remember Stevie Wonder, the musician, being thanked for writing a song once, and he said, "Well, don't worry," he said, "it didn't come from me, it came through me." Is that too much?
Well, it's true that one has pause for thought, because the likes of you and I, we sort of struggle with the equations. I have to use them in physics. It's always an effort to learn it all, but, you know, I get there. But there are some people who are mathematical geniuses, and they're just sort of born with a talent, and there are some spectacular examples. Probably the best known is that of Ramanujan, the Indian, only elementarily educated young fellow in the 1920s, who was able to write down new mathematical relationships of a very subtle and peculiar nature without proving them at all. He just could pluck them out of this Platonic heaven and write them down. And he sent these equations to a very famous mathematician at Cambridge University by the name of Hardy. And Hardy invited Ramanujan to come to Cambridge to join him. And Ramanujan did, but suffered from cultural shock, and he was a vegetarian, couldn't get decent vegetarian food in Britain in those days, and sort of began to waste away and went back to India and died an early death. And it's still very unclear how Ramanujan and a handful of these other mathematical geniuses, who are just in a total class apart, completely different, they're not just very good at mathematics, they can somehow pluck it out of nowhere and write it down.
Incredible.
Often without proof.
Incredible. Totally incredible. I mean, I guess we talk about who does the mind belong to, and in connection with sense of self. That was part of what you wrote about, the mind belonging to an outside source or something, I suppose.
Well, we tend to think that we have personal identity, and that it's, you know, our minds and our bodies and so on. But that sense of self is another one of these things that when you start to unpack it, to analyze it in more detail, it gets very slippery. And it's clear that if I talk about me, Paul Davies, a person, a sense of self, a sense of responsibility, a sense of being able to make decisions, but actually we are all many individuals amalgamated, that there is that the self is really like a whole society of influences. And I think this is pretty clear. And when I say society, I mean within one brain, within one mind.
Yes.
That a community of different influences. And where this is really brought home to you, I think, is when you have an ethical dilemma. Well, I really like to do this, but I think maybe I should do that. And there's, you know, the better nature and the selfish nature and all the other aspects that sort of clamor for attention in your head. And then you end up with some sort of, you know, negotiation or compromise. But it's very clear that there are lots of bits of us, and it isn't a unitary entity. It's, it comes together as a community with an overall identity, except, of course, in conditions like schizophrenia, where the personality can become fragmented. But if you're able to integrate all this, you do have this overwhelming presence that I am a single individual. But, of course, even with that impression, you change over time. And so you're not the same person now as you were when you were 5 years old. And I think that's a very important aspect. I think it's what gives the world the illusion that time is flowing or changing. Time isn't flowing or changing. The world changes. Our selves change. Time itself doesn't change. no answers there.
This would be interesting, actually, if we have time, maybe discuss the flow of time at a later discussion. But just briefly, as a finish up, and we thank you so much for your time, Paul. I guess that information inside our heads and how we, our reaction to those different sensations, is that our consciousness?
It's pretty clear that if we didn't have a sense of time of one moment to the next, then the notion of thinking would be rather meaningless. There's a train of thought, we use that expression all the time, a sequence of mental states. If that were somehow frozen, I think that the consciousness wouldn't be anything remotely like what we experience it. So the nature of consciousness and the nature of time are very, very deeply interwoven.
I mean, it's always been an awesome subject, and in that regard, because of the numbers, I guess you mentioned in the book that there are 100 billion neurons in the brain, about the same as the number of stars in the galaxy. And
yes.
I guess that's incredible in itself, with cascades of signals being sent off, as you so poetically put it. Is there a chance we may never find out a consciousness and its source with all that those numbers to contend with?
Well, it is a daunting complexity, and at the moment we're really only scratching the surface of it. There are signs of hope. Because although you just stated the, these very big numbers, and they are big, nevertheless, the brain isn't just a sort of haphazard collection of neurons and wires connecting them. It organizes itself into modules, and each individual module might have simpler behavior than you don't need to go down to the level of individual neurons to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So with that type of aggregation, it may not be so bad. But I think we're a very long way from being able to simulate a brain. Some years ago, I was involved in something called, it was then called the Blue Brain Project, now called the Human Brain Project,
mm-hmm.
right out of Lausanne in Switzerland.
Yeah.
And the plan there was to do for the brain like the Human Genome Project did for the genome. And to just throw vast computing resources at it and try to simulate consciousness, or simulate at least the working of a real human brain in a computer, a big enough computer. But it rapidly became clear that we're a long way from having the information processing power to be able to even reproduce what's going on in a very small section of the brain. So
mm-hmm.
I think we're not there yet.
Well, look, Paul, we thank you immensely for your ongoing work in this area, shedding light to people like myself, I guess, who are interested in the topic but could never reel off the numbers or the facts in regards to this. We thank you, and I think education is a beautiful thing, and you've been part of that. So thanks for joining us at The Last Post.
Oh, it's been great fun. Thank you.